Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, kid-lit notables, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 154 with Rowboat Watkins, author-illustrator of Rude Cakes, published by Chronicle Books. Rowboat's debut picture book is as much about ill-behaved pastries and well-mannered monsters as it is about the child listening to it being read aloud, or even the adult reading it. We've all been a little bit rude cakes from time to time, and that's okay. I was actually quite taken aback by my conversation with Rowboat, and much like his book, I loved getting to know the story that's churning in him beneath the guy I only previously knew from the blurb on his book jacket. Well, I hope you enjoy the listen. Here is episode number 154 of the podcast with Rowboat Watkins. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Rowboat Watkins. I'm super excited to get to talk to you tonight.
Oh, thanks, Matthew. It's my pleasure to talk to you.
Hey, let me thank you off the bat for writing Rude Cakes, because I've gotten the opportunity to enjoy it for, I don't know, something like a month or something now. And I've read it and read it and read it to my son, to now at school I'm reading it to kids, and it's very exciting for them that I keep saying, no, this book isn't out yet. It's not on our library shelves because it doesn't technically exist in the world yet. But it's been such a joy to read it and to share it. And that's all you. Thank you for writing a story that's so lovely and lovable already.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I mean, I'm sure it's true with all the other people that you've spoken to. You know, you work on something for so long, and then you wait for so long for something to come out, and you kind of lose your ability to even know what it is anymore. You know, you hope that it's your best effort and that people are going to like it. So it's very heartening to hear that it's out there and that your kids are liking it.
Yeah, it's a lovely book. I think the reason why it works so well over and over too is just that you've got such a great twist midway. Somehow, and this is something that might just be a mystery, or maybe you're just this brilliant writer that knows how to accomplish this, but somehow that twist, and I won't spoil it, but that twist feels new every single time I read it. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking, I've read it between 30 and 40 times.
That's great.
It's impressive and lovely that happens. Actually, why don't I give you the floor to just share with the listening audience what Rude Cakes is all about.
Well, it's hard to say.
I mean, being rude,
it's
cake.
About a rude cake, and it's about his or her. I mean, I have my perception of whether it's a boy or a girl, but it doesn't really matter. About the cakes learning how to think about anyone outside of himself. I mean, it's kind of a manners book that makes fun of being a manners book. And, you know, I'm reluctant to kind of spoil the twist too. And I wish I could take credit for brilliance, but it was really just a total random lucky observation when I was dummying up the book and looking at the thumbnails that I realized that the story that I thought I was writing didn't have to be the story that I thought it was, that it could actually go in a different direction. And so it was really just the kind of unexpected surprise of working on the book and not entirely knowing where I was going to go and being open to the possibility that it could be something different, which is not really brilliant at all. It's just kind of being lucky and just kind of being open to something kind of discovering itself. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. Just the idea of trusting yourself and trusting the story and giving it time to sort of reveal itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I constantly find myself drawing back to teaching in this when I have conversations with people such as yourself. That is because I come from teaching. But there's something like that in education too, when you're developing a unit, a project that you're not really sure where it's going to go with the kids and how it'll turn out. And if you're able to trust yourself in a project like that, and I feel like I do, I feel like that's what I'm drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is something about the journey and trusting that where it goes, the things you encounter will work themselves out. And that's part of what makes the end product so genuine and so sincere, I think.
Yeah, and sometimes they don't work out. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, I've written plenty of dummies that just are stalled, you know, indefinitely. And, you know, you kind of hope that, or I hope that in the process of working something, that there's some spirit of play, that it's not just some grim slog, or that there's not just some formulaic approach to coming up with a finished product, but that there's just a process of discovering and enjoying oneself. And that's really kind of what I was trying to do with the book, was to kind of, for all of the kind of unavoidable elements of work that come with putting a book together, just to really try and experience as much pleasure and play and fun as I could. And that was true for the writing and for the drawing of the pictures and redrawing the pictures. And anytime it started feeling stilted, or I started feeling nervous or tentative, or like I was trying to prove something, I stopped working on it. I put it away. And then I would start again, because I really wanted to have it feel fresh and to remove as much of my ego from the book. And it's, you know, there's unavoidably a lot of ego in making a book and putting your words there and your pictures, because sure, you're putting it out there for people to look at. But, you know, trying to find a way to do it in the least egoful way, if that makes sense, you know. You know, I mean, it really has been like the big thing that I've been trying to do, is just to try and remember to have fun. Cause that's the quality that I like when I look at the authors and illustrators who work. I like, and when I look at kids telling stories to each other, it just seems like, you know, I listen to my daughter tell stories and she clearly has no idea where the story's going to go. And she's just confidently kind of soldiering on with some completely absurd story that is just great. And if she tried to plan it out, it would just sound totally implausible. And it's implausible anyway, but it still has a kind of authenticity to it, because she's just so into the telling of it.
Oh, I should say too that, and this is from your play and just the way you ended up designing characters, you created a character that I immediately felt. I should ask first, are you familiar with Travis Jonker and his blog 100 Scope Notes?
I'm recently familiar with him, yeah.
I love and adore Travis's blog for so many different reasons, especially the way he looks at picture books and art and the way books are constructed and things like that. But there's always sort of this end of the year wrap up where he kind of does this quirky thing where he talks about all the different things we remember from the books that came out that year. And it might be just memorable characters or funny lines or really kind of sometimes surprising or humorous or disgusting things that happen in certain stories.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a character in this book that I wanted to send off to Travis right away, because you have a mustached cake.
Mm-hmm.
This is I have never seen and will never see again a mustached cake. And it's the greatest thing ever.
Well,
I don't know why, that I'm just tickled by that.
That was the way I could make him seem like a dad. I mean, I was,
yeah.
I'm glad that you like the mustache cake.
Pink mustache cake. I love it. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. And I, you know, I spent a lot of time kind of redrawing the mom and the dad, and the main root cake of the story, and his friends or antagonists or his there's a lot of kind of going back and forth about what elements I wanted to have there and what worked and what didn't work and whether they had noses or didn't have noses. And, I had a great, art director who was, incredibly helpful throughout the process of trying to shape the book into something that seemed like the best version of itself.
Whether they have noses or not. I love the cakes. Good point, Robo. Good point.
Well, it was weird because, I mean, for the longest time, they were actually, I've been drawing cakes for probably 10 or 12 years, and they have always had noses. I mean, they mostly had mustaches. But I had never drawn a cake without a nose until I was playing with making the noses smaller and smaller. And one day, the art director, the designer, she said, well, why don't you just try it without a nose? Maybe it doesn't need a nose at all. And I remember showing it to my wife and she was like, what have you done? This is horrible. Your cakes have to have noses. And I said, well, I think that she might be right. I think that we're just so used to seeing them with noses, but maybe, I mean, they can't smell anyway. I mean, they can't. So
you've got, I love the trying to apply logic to a book about cakes is great. And you've even got another thing in there where you're even like winking to the audience about where's the cakes think that baths are dumb.
Oh yeah.
It's like, seriously, yeah. I'm a cake. How dirty can I be?
Yeah. No, I mean, I like that kind of direct address of the reader there. Right? That's the one moment where I think it's kind of looking and kind of, like you said, winking at the audience.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh my word. You do. There's so much right here and just so much lovely. And it's great. And what a great debut too. It's hard to believe reading this that it's the first thing you have being published, but it's also super exciting knowing that, oh my word, we've got, a world to discover with you. I'm excited to see more art. Oh, and I should say I saw more art from, when you had a blog post on with Jules on mm-hmm. Seven Impossible Things.
Yep.
That was great.
Oh, thank you. She was really fun to talk to. She has great questions and so I felt really lucky to have a chance to have a conversation with her.
Oh, and to be able to see, Jules and I were talking one day about how she had to buy like an extra, maybe several hard drives to handle all of the images that she gets in and keeps from people like you, because her blog posts are always so illustration rich and photo rich, and that's part of what makes them so wonderful. And it's really neat to, I'll put a link in the show notes, but I love getting to see some of your process and some of your character design through that. And she does that really well. So yeah, that was cool.
I'm curious, I look at what you do and what Jules does, and I wonder, like, how many of you are there? Like, are there three Matthew winners? Because I don't know how you do all of the things that you do. And I wonder, like, how Jules does all the things that she does. Because, I see what I do, and there's only one of me, but I do much less than what you guys do. And I don't know how you make it seem so effortless to be juggling so many balls at the same time and wearing so many hats.
You sketch and draw and do that all the time. This is a hobby for me. This is fun for me. So this is, like, the thing that I look forward to. I come home and I play with my son and we do our bath time routine and I have dinner with my wife. And then we, after bedtime, it's either, playing video games or getting to talk to cool people like you. So it's just, maybe it's just that bigger picture of when it's not work, it doesn't seem to take up time mm-hmm. in life. It's something that maybe even gives me more energy and gives me more excitement and enthusiasm when I talk like now talking to you, I can't stop thinking about the readers that I just got to see all day today. I got to teach, a full day of classes and share your book. I was actually sharing with you earlier that I jumped in with a project with my kindergartners using your book as inspiration. And it's fun to just get to play and know that these books are coming out with kids and that we get to interact with them the way that we do. It's a special thing.
Are there some times in your downtime when you think about kind of drawing and kind of working on picture books of your own? I mean, you're so kind of immersed in the picture book world, and you're clearly a verbal, playful, fun person. Is that something that seems interesting to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think anyone that spends as much time in anything, but specifically for me in children's literature, it's hard not to see yourself writing a story and yearning a little bit for that publication. And I've been writing now I would say not seriously. I take the podcast much more seriously, and I take teaching much more seriously, mm-hmm. and of course being a dad much more seriously mm-hmm. Than the time that I'm committing to writing. But I have a couple picture book manuscripts that I've been working on with my critique group. I've been in a critique group for about a year, and I kind of consider just all the time that I get to spend with people such as yourself and with the children every day. Just that's kind of my classroom. I just kind of keep thinking, and things are churning in my head, and who knows, maybe someday it'll be the right time for me mm-hmm. to pursue more seriously being published, or maybe the stories that I write are more meant to be written mm-hmm. as a practice, and know that I'm able to accomplish writing a story. That was a big thing for me. I've written, as I said, several picture book manuscripts, and it feels good to know that, like, oh wow, I can craft a story. Whether or not it's marketable is a different skill, but just the act of being able to write is a really neat thing, to be able to tell a story and share it with a couple of your friends.
Is it hard? Do you find that it's hard to share with your crit group, or was it hard to get to a place where you trusted them, or were these people that you already knew? I mean, I'm curious how you arrived at
these are friends from school that we over time were sharing, that we had this common interest, and I think initially it was hard to expose myself that way and sharing something that I had written, because it's so precious, I think, when mm-hmm. you write. It is very precious, much like if someone were to, I don't know, record when I speak somewhere at a conference, if someone were to record it and post it anywhere, and then heaven forbid people were like commenting on it, mm-hmm. That would freak me out quite a bit.
Yeah.
To write it and have it written feels really nice, and feels really something like I can take pride in, much like writing, or much like presenting somewhere. But when it comes back to you, it gets, I don't know, it's only been since doing this for a year now, and seeing them, building trust is really, I guess, what it's all about, seeing them share, and hearing their criticism, and being able to learn to take criticism, and learn to know when it's okay to just put something down. Or I'm sure you could tell me that there are plenty of things that you've probably felt precious with in the beginning that instead were more, I don't know, like stepping stones to get you to Rude Cakes.
Yeah, well, that's definitely true. I think also, and something I've been thinking a lot about, is just learning how to be a better listener. I mean, it's such an obvious point. It's embarrassing that it's taken me so long in my life to learn to do it, but just to learn how to negotiate working with a group of people, because the truth is, you know, a picture book is a lot of people working on it. I mean, it may have my, you know, the author's name or the illustrator's name on it in the end, but, you know, there's an editor and a designer, and there are salespeople and marketing people and publicity people, and it's very easy for me, I can't speak for anybody else, to kind of assume that secretly everybody kind of has an adversarial relationship, that they may be pretending to be your ally, but that all they're really trying to do is kind of change your kind of precious charge in a way that works to their advantage, but maybe not yours. And it sounds so paranoid when I say it, and I realize now that, you know, it was so important to learn how to trust the people who were talking to me, because they, you know, they know a lot more about a lot of things than I know. And it was key to learn how to understand their input to kind of shape the book in a way that was going to work for everybody. And then there were also times when I also had to learn to trust my voice and to say, you know what, I'm trying to see what you're saying here, but I really feel very strongly that it needs to be this way. And, you know, figuring out that kind of dance. I mean, it's, you know, like you're talking about, just learning to trust somebody. And that's not something that necessarily comes right away. It comes through a process of having a back and forth and, you know, feeling that somebody understands your sensibility and you understand theirs, and you develop a relationship. And I, you know, I can't thank my editor, Victoria, and my designer, Sarah, enough, because, you know, as much as there were a lot of things that were, I'd like to think, were right about the book when they first acquired it, you know, their input was just totally invaluable in terms of making the book what it is now. You know?
I think that really speaks to to the process too for people that haven't been through publishing to know that, that when you sell a book that it that that's not the end of the edits or the end of the adaptation of the story, that it's
oftentimes the beginning. I mean, yeah, like you can have something.
It's like a gesture of good faith, but that's just the start.
And again, I can only speak from my experience. I mean, there may be people who are selling books and they're just exquisite kind of iterations of themselves that just need to be kind of buffed with a chamois before they're published. You know, there was a lot of massaging that needed to happen, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of kind of revisions and to kind of maintain the freshness through the process of making all those changes over and over again. You know, I think that's why a lot of books, you know, sometimes feel a little bit overworked. You know, they can be beautiful and great and accomplished. But I'm always amazed when somebody like a Matthew Cordell makes a book that just seems like it was tossed off in a day, you know, and that he's preserved all of that kind of vitality in the finished illustrations, you know. I think it's incredible. It's like magic to me. Somebody can rework something over and over again and still have that kind of immediacy in the finished book.
The respect I have for artists and authors alike, but to artists, it's so much easier to just see. And Matthew is that way. Matt Cordell's that way, that when you look at his illustrations, they look like he just sat down and made them, and that was it. And you know, there must have been tons and tons of character exploration and of design work and of trying at different mediums and all of those things, but to see it look still a little raw on the page, there's something really, really nice about that. It looks like perfect in its imperfection.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm not really sure how else to articulate it, but yeah, he's one that I look to a lot. I mean, there's even others, but on the other side of it, I look at people like Brian Wunn, who debuted with Hooray for Hat.
I don't know that book.
Oh, I can't wait for you to read that book. It's so stripped down to I feel like the fewest words and the most direct art possible, and yet to get to that point, you just know that things don't come out that way.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been an incredible amount of editing and restraint, and trying to preserve what needed to be preserved, while at the same time allowing yourself to let go what has to let go to let the story stand the way it needs to. So
yeah,
oh yeah.
No, I mean, I know that Matthew talks a lot about people like Quentin Blake and John Birmingham, and you know, I don't know about Birmingham's process, but I know that Blake, there was a book where he basically talked about just kind of redrawing things over and over again just to get the quality of the lines right on each of the characters. So that each thing that looks kind of totally dashed off may have been done 40 times or 20 times or however many times just to get that, you know, that just right sense of immediacy.
Well, so Robot, how do you do your art, or how did you do the art with Rude Cakes? Because I know you were saying that you do your work at the computer, and yeah, it definitely has that quality of looking like, I mean, I love when I look close at this art, the way that you're seeing paint go outside of the lines, the way that you see that nice sort of, I'm not even sure how you created the texture, but on the Cyclopses, there's a minor spoiler. There are Cyclopses in this story, but they've got just this nice sort of like chalk or crayon kind of texture it looks on them. But did you create all the work digitally though?
No, I mean, as much of it as I can do by hand.
I do
by hand. I mean, I wish I were a watercolorist. It's like one of my life's dreams to know how to use watercolors, and I can slop around with them with my daughter, but you know, I don't feel comfortable using real watercolors. So I use digital watercolors. There's a guy named Robert Ardell who I randomly found on YouTube. And he's a real life watercolorist who developed his own set of brushes, for $10 to buy the whole package of brushes and papers. And, he's got these free tutorials online, and it was like this weird eye opening kind of miracle I'd been looking forever to find something to use on the computer, because there's, you know, so much redrawing that you have to do a book, and the idea of kind of doing a watercolor and then having to do the watercolor again and again and again because I made a mistake or I chose the wrong color just made it seem impossible. So, you know, all the line work is done with pencil on paper. I create a lot of textures just in my sketchbook, or rubbing random things in the house, or taking pictures of the sidewalk, or whatever. It could be anything. And I just keep, I have a big library of random textures. And then it's just all kind of pieced together, as I think a lot of people do it, just, you know, in Photoshop, just to try and assemble all of the elements. But, you know, they all start out as doodles in sketchbook. And I've really been trying to kind of use my sketchbook as a model for how I want the kind of the finished illustrations to look. I spent so much of my life trying to figure out why the things that I work on so hard kind of feel stilted and lifeless, and why the things that I, you know, just kind of dashed off in my sketchbook kind of continue to catch my attention. And I just realized at some point I should just, why not just make finished things that are just as much like the sketchbook as I can make them without having it feel kind of inauthentic, you know, trying to preserve whatever. And that's what it gets back to, that sense of play, or, you know, that trying to remove the kind of onerousness from the process of making them, because it so easily can become onerous for me. And I fall into the same traps, and just trying to unlearn bad patterns of behavior and overworking things to the point where they just are completely joyless for anybody to experience. You know,
I can see that a lot in your art, that there's a quality to your thin, broken line that does feel like a sketchbook. It feels like, especially the way it lends itself in this story, which is sort of, it feels a little bit of a dream world. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can imagine a kid having a hard day at school and going home and dreaming about cakes being rude to one another and their parents. But when you look close at the art, it feels, everything feels like nicely blended together. Everything feels like it's sort of soft and welcoming. I guess the quality I'm seeing it as is here we are talking about young people being brats, as it were, to other people in life, not just their parents, but certainly to their friends, to everyone. But all of that is handled in such a way that it's look, let's not vilify anyone. Mm-hmm. Let's just take it as I could be reading way too far into your book, but the notion of these of this sweet treat, this cute pink adorable thing being rude, I think is not unlike children.
I think it's certainly like my child. I mean, my daughter is the first rude cake. I mean, I don't know that it was intentionally written about her, but, you know, I mean, she has an incredible capacity to be a rude cake and a giant cyclops and a lot of things. But, you know, I think that you touched on it just before, which is that I really, you know, I think the picture, I was trying to preserve some element of sweetness, because, you know, I know that the characters can veer towards a kind of grotesqueness. I think somebody actually talked about them being grotesque, adorably grotesque. And the story, you know, it's a weird story. I mean, it's not going to work for everybody. And I realize that it's not, you know, and there are going to be some people. It was actually a discussion that I had with, you know, with Chronicle when they were acquiring the book and thinking about how people were going to respond to it, and were people going to be, you know, upset that the cake was rude, and did there need to be any kind of backstory that, you know, kind of explained that maybe the cakes by default are not rude. And this is an exception, but, you know, obviously the joke is kind of that, you know, everybody assumes by default that all cakes are nice, that, you know, that if you're not in on the joke, then the premise of the book isn't going to be funny to you anyway. That I'm assuming that most people go through life assuming that the cakes that they're encountering and devouring were sweet by nature and just complied with being consumed, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wanted the book to have a sweetness, and, you know, I think my conception of what the sweetness was maybe not as sweet as it needed to be, and the book looks the way that it does, again, because, you know, the designer was just so insistent on having a palette that was more inviting than what I originally had it looking like. So
it's great. The way it turns out is great, and I'm so glad to have that connection, that everyone assumes that all cakes are nice, and that's the approach you took. We, when I took attendance with my kindergartners this morning, I was saying that I was doing that activity with them, inspired by your book. The question, I always call attendance and I ask some sort of a question, so rather than them saying here, they just respond with the answer to a question, and the question was, which one is nicer, cakes or Cyclops?
Mm-hmm.
And to have that premise of kind of flipping that on its head was cute. I gotta say though, on the other side, I can't stop thinking that when I look at your cake, when I look at your character design, for whatever reason, I see your cake in the world of the Brave Little Toaster, which I think is a really good thing. Like, here's a thing that doesn't look scary or threatening, but you could see could have a quality where it could, you know, have to blow off some steam here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's great. Everything, Robo, I love your design, all of this. And knowing the people that were behind it and the work that you did with them to accomplish this publication, I think it really turned out amazing, and I'm excited that other people get to read it because it's just charming. It's super charming.
Thank you. I would actually be curious to know if you asked your kids how many of them think of themselves as rude kids or not, because I've only read it to my daughter, and she's willing to concede that she's a rude kid some of the time, not as much as she actually is a rude kid. And I gave a copy of the book to the grandson of a friend of my parents. And he was one of the early readers, and I've been emailing back and forth with him through his grandmother. And he was asking about how I had arrived at the idea of writing a book about rude cakes. And I was just telling him, I basically think that all people are a little bit rude cake, and that all kids are especially a little bit rude cake, especially though they don't think that they are. And he wrote back saying, I'm never rude. I've never been rude in my entire life. And I wrote him back and said, it's not possible. I mean, I tried to say it very nicely. I said, but there has to have been some moment where you were rude and you just weren't aware of it. And he said, no, I never was. I've never been rude in my entire life. So I'm curious whether kids are able to see, you know, that, you know, themselves in the character, because I was trying to write the book in a way where hopefully it was allowing people some kind of non-defensive way of looking at their own kind of self-involved rudeness.
Yeah, and all of the time I've read it has been much more connecting with the act of being rude. But here, talking to you now, the concept of actually being this sort of having outbursts of rudeness in a sweet package, I think is something that it would be really fun to talk to with children. I would love to see when we do any sort of our I don't know, school character sort of celebrations that we have, where, like, I'm picturing when kids make their own T-shirts for International Dot Day and things like that. I'd love to see kids, like, design some sort of a graphic tee that says, I am a rude gay. Just own it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. It's a great way to approach it, and I think that it would be cute to have kids walking around admitting that they're rude cakes. I got them to walk around singing that song, Rude, if that's a step in the right direction. They were, why are you gonna be so rude?
Mm-hmm.
As they were carrying these cakes on their holding them up over their foreheads.
I'm curious, do you see yourself, do you see the rude cake in yourself at all?
Oh, there are absolutely moments where I hate to admit that I know that I'm rude to people that are rude to me, among mm-hmm. other times. That's one that will get me to be rude right away.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's the part we don't like to admit about ourselves, but it's there underneath all the sugary sweet icing. It's definitely there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I also have to I don't want to leave you without saying, and I'm sure you talk about it all the time, but I love your name, and I especially love it because it feels, and I've read your About Me page, so I know that your wife sort of named you Robo, mm-hmm. and I love that it is what it is, but I also love it because it feels sort of like a name out of Mark Twain or something like that. And so I also wanted to share with you directly, having had this firsthand experience reading your book and introducing you by name to children, that children, at least the ones I work with, think that you have the greatest name of any author I've ever shared with them. And that, I think that you should just know that you have instant street cred with them.
Well, that goes totally to my wife's credit then, because I, you know, she was the one who christened me with the name, and, you know, I wish that I were, you know, suave enough to have merited a different kind of boat name, but, you know, I am, for better or for worse, I am, if you met me in person, you would see that I am exactly like a rowboat. So, Yeah, it is what it is.
Well, you can look forward to when you start doing school visits that you might also have the mistake that specifically my kindergartners and my preschool kids made, which is that they started calling you Robot Watkins.
I've heard a lot of people saying that.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I mean, well,
then you'll be ready for it.
Yeah, it's weird that somehow being Robot Watkins seems like a more natural thing than being Robot Watkins, but
I know.
But I guess robots are more on people's radar than robots.
I was just going to say, maybe it's more on our, more a part of our vernacular.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful.
Oh, but I'm glad that they like the name. I mean,
It'll be not only fun for them to meet you and to know your name, but then to have it packaged in that you'll be drawing cakes with them, rude cakes with them, talking about how we're all a little bit rude. I think that the whole thing, I don't know. I look at something like this in the way that I'm already excited to be using it with my kids. And so I think about what it'll be like for those school visits and Skype visits and things like that with you. And I just think that you, it'll be a lot of fun right out of the gate. And so I wish you a lot of fun and joy in the book release and all that gets to come from that.
Thank you very much, Matthew. That's very nice.
Hey, before I let you go, do you mind if I ask you just one more question, the traditional question around the podcast? Is that all right?
Sure.
Cool, man. Well, so here it is. I'm assembling an all-star kid-lit dream team kickball tournament, and I'd love to know what one person you would want on your team, alive or past, from the kid-lit world, and why.
Yeah, it's a hard question. I know you've asked this question of a lot of people, so I've had time to think about it, and my answer was going to be Sergio Ruzier, who it still might be my answer because he's just such an incredible person. He's a lovely friend, and I so admire his work, and I know he would be just super fun to have on the team because he would probably bring cocktails and he would have snarky things to say about the other team. And I have no idea how he would actually perform as a kickball player. I would actually be so just utterly panic stricken with performance anxiety of my own having to step up to the plate and kick the ball. But it would be a toss up between him and Maury Sendak, who I talked about a little bit with Jules on her blog. Yeah. That I was lucky enough to get to go and live in a house next to his house for a month as part of the Sendak Fellowship, and I stayed friends with him after the fellowship was done, and I've never had a mentor before, and I wasn't really looking for a mentor. But there was something really powerful about getting to meet, one of my life's heroes and to become his friend before he died and to have the last few years of his life, where I would go up and have lunch with him every couple months, few months. And, and his not being here is very sad. And I miss being able to talk to him. And I'm sad that he never got to see this book come out. So, I think he would be a terrible kickball player. And I think he would probably only have the most derisive things to say about anybody who was playing in the game. But he would be great fun to have on the sideline, and it would be a great excuse to have him back here. So if I could pick two, I would pick Sergio, and I would pick Maurice.
Ah, I think those are perfect picks for every reason that you gave. That's wonderful. Robo, thank you so much for coming to chat with me and for sharing Rude Cakes with me and for everyone listening and just for being out there for our readers. I'm excited to see what's to come with you, but also just the way that Rude Cakes will resonate with readers, big adult grown-up readers like me and also those kids. I'm excited for that and excited for you as well. So congratulations again.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew. It was a really great pleasure talking to you. So, and I look forward to listening to more of your podcasts throughout the year.
Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts.
That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.